Welcome to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. Often, physics is something we study for a little bit in high school and college and don't think about afterwards. So it's easy to overlook the fact that physics can tell us so much about the way the world works, from the big things like climate change to the small things we encounter daily. That's why we've decided to turn to this topic for our latest Please Explain. Helen Cheresky is a physicist at University College London and is a science presenter for BBC. Her new book is Storm in a Teacup, The Physics of Everyday Life. Helen Cheresky, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And we want to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have a question about the way the world works that you want a physicist to answer? Give us a call at 212-433-9692, or you can write us on Twitter at Midday on WNYC. So, Helen, what within the world of physics, what is your specialty?
I study bubbles in the ocean. I've done a few different types of physics, but really I'm interested in the physics that you can see and play with, and that carries through to my own research. So I study the bubbles underneath breaking waves. And it's a great thing because seafarers have looked out at stormy seas for centuries, but that little bit just under the surface, they couldn't see and they couldn't really get to because, you know, no one wants to be out in that. And so I study that. It's right there, but it's still a little bit unknown.
You study bubbles.
Yeah, it's a real job. It's good, isn't it?
I know, this is fantastic. So what is it, or what was it, about bubbles under the sea, as you said, that captured your fascination?
Well, bubbles are interesting because, I mean, they make everyone smile and everyone's familiar with them, but actually they're quite elusive because they do a lot of things slightly too fast to be seen. And so when a wave breaks and the bubbles get carried underwater, the first thing that happens is that all the turbulence, all the water kind of meshing around, breaks the bubbles up, and so they fragment and they break and break and break. And it was that process that really got me into it, this idea that right in that kind of mishmash bit, you know, sort of a bit like a washing machine when it's all very complicated, just after a wave breaks, you're creating bubbles. And the great thing about that process is that you don't just make bubbles, you can actually hear them, because every time you make a new bubble by smashing it apart, you know, you smash a big bubble to get two little bubbles, you get a sound that's produced, so you can actually hear this process. And so the lovely thing about this was that I could do, I mean, for me, when I first started, I could do all these things that interested me. I could do the high-speed photography to look at the stuff that was happening slightly too fast for me to see, and I could listen to it happening, and then I could go out in the natural world and watch it happening and watch the consequences for the planet, because all these bubbles at the sea surface aren't just sitting there. You know, they're helping the ocean breathe. They're spitting tiny particles up into the atmosphere. They're doing things. You know, they're part of the engine of the ocean.
Well, Helen, let me ask you this. You write that, quote, the most important thing about a wave is that it's a way of letting energy move, but without also having to move air, water, or stuff of any kind. Talk more about that.
Yes, this is the thing. So you'll have seen this. If anyone who looks out at the coast, you know, there's kind of waves and swell rolling in. And where I used to live in San Diego, there are always pelicans sitting on the water, right? So you watch one of those pelicans. And here's the interesting thing is that the waves roll in off the sea. And the pelican kind of bobs up and down, but it doesn't go anywhere. And what that's telling you is that the water isn't going anywhere. You know, it goes up and down a bit, but it doesn't move. But you can be, you know, quite a long way from the pelican, and the wave goes from the pelican. Moves to you. It moves energy from over there to over here, but stuff doesn't go anywhere. And that's really useful in the universe. You know, there's all these waves, there's light waves moving around, the sound waves moving about down here on Earth. And so this energy is being shunted about all the time by these waves, but stuff isn't going anywhere, which is kind of convenient, because otherwise the world would be like a waterfall, right? I mean, can you imagine how convenient, inconvenient it would be if stuff had to move every time energy moved?
Right.
You know, there'd be one great big car crash.
Helen, let me ask you this, because you say that bubbles, and maybe I missed it in an earlier answer, but you say, or you have said, that bubbles are the unsung heroes of the physical world.
Yes, everyone underappreciates bubbles, and it's not just because I've got a bee in my bonnet about it. the thing about bubbles is that wherever they are, they're usually doing something, and we sort of take those things for granted. Because the bubbles are slightly too fast, we don't notice it. So wherever there's a bubble, you've got a gas and a liquid. So I'm talking not about soap bubbles, but underwater, you know, gas bubbles in water. And so the gas and the liquid are kind of not mixing. That's why you've got a bubble, because it doesn't all just mush together into one thing. And those bubbles can be creating sound, they can be mixing, so they can be transferring gases. You know, when you have bubbles in champagne, for example, you've got gas in the champagne that is coming out to form a bubble, and the bubble is carrying the gas up to the surface. So in that case, the bubbles are doing something, they're carrying flavor molecules. And when you pour out a drink, and you pour out a glass of water, and it goes bip, 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 and you get this little sort of tinkling noise. That is the sound of bubbles being formed, and so you can hear them doing things. And so everywhere where bubbles are, they're up to something.
Well, Helen, we have a caller who is actually on topic here in Harlem in New York City. Gregory, you have a question about bubbles.
Yes, I do. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I was always fascinated by the idea that there's something called surface tension, like when you I drink martinis. So when you have a glass that's completely full, but over the top of the rim, there seems to be more liquid sticking up over the top. Does that relate to bubbles at all?
Oh, I totally know what you're talking about, Gregory.
It is. So surface tension is what makes bubbles mostly spherical most of the time. So you're right that the surface of a liquid acts a little bit like an elastic sheet. It doesn't have any elastic in it, but it behaves as though it's kind of being pulled together. And so what you can see, if you fill a glass all the way up to the top and then keep going really slowly, is that the water kind of bulges up, but it doesn't fall over the side, at least not for a little while. And that's the reason it happens is that the water molecules are so attracted to each other that they kind of pull inwards. And so they keep the water together, even though it could fall over the side. And so in the case of a bubble, for example, you've got, you know, gas and water, and they're not mixing together, so there has to be some shape for the bubble. And so what the bubble does, because of surface tension, is it pulls, the surface pulls to make the smallest area possible, and that's a sphere. So bubbles are actually not spherical quite often. You know, in the situation I described with bubbles being smashed about in the ocean, they're being stretched and squished, but all the time the surface tension is pulling them back to a sphere. And so it's really important, you know, and we do see it everywhere in the world, not just in the shape of bubbles, but it's how, for example, you know, when you put, but if you spill something, you put towel down and water gets kind of sucked up inside the towel. Surface tension is part of making that happen.
And Helen, you're racing ahead to a question I was going to ask about coffee. Gregory, thank you very much for your call and making me understand that I was not the only one who was seeing that little bubble of martini over my glass. Helen, there's a fun party trick you write about, and that is putting raisins in a bottle of carbonated lemonade. What happens when you do that?
So, well, half of me wants to say, you know what, your listeners should just kind of do it and find out, because that's the fun of all this physics, right? You don't have to listen to me telling you, but I will tell you a little bit about the raisins. And so it's a good, it helps if you take the label off the soda bottle first, you know. But if you put the raisins in, you just kind of drop a handful of raisins. And you want the nice wrinkly ones. Those are the more dried out they are, the better it'll work. So you drop them in, and the raisins are more dense than the water, which means they sink to the bottom, which is fine. Except that then what happens is that your soda, your carbonated drink, whatever it is, has dissolved gas in it. And the dissolved gas, there's too much dissolved gas in the water. So it's going to, you know, it wants to escape to the air, but it needs a place to start. And the raisins are a great place for it to start. So what happens is that on the surface of the raisins, bubbles start to grow because the gas can come out from the liquid and become a gas again, but in little pockets. And the raisins grow themselves a life jacket. And then after they've grown themselves a little coating of bubbles, this life jacket, they, they're less dense than the water, so they float upwards, and then they get to the top, and then they kind of turn over until all the bubbles are popped, and then they go back down. And this will carry, I mean, it's like the cheapest lava lamp you'll ever buy. You keep going for half an hour with a, you know, kind of a 2-litre bottle of soda, whatever that is in your language. I can't remember.
Right.
Whatever those are.
Helen, that is fantastic. When I get home, I'm going to try that. Everyone, you're listening to Helen Cherusky, who's the author of Storm in a Teacup, The Physics of Everyday Life. Helen is a physicist. She is fascinated and has studied bubbles and bubbles in the ocean. She has an entire chapter on waves, which we have talked about. Helen, I've got to ask you about popcorn. What's going on when we pop popcorn?
So it's one of those lovely things which is, it's hit, like it's right there, but you don't see it. You don't see what's going on the inside. So the game with popcorn is that the reason that popcorn kernels are different from other kinds of corn kernels is that they're really waterproof. So you've got this popcorn, and it's got all this starch in it, because that's the food for the, you know, if you leave the corn, it will be a seed, and it will, you know, a new plant will grow. And so the starch in the corn kernel for that to happen. But when you put a piece of dried popcorn in a hot pan, that starch and the water that's with it all starts to heat up, but it's trapped inside that hard outer shell. So it's almost like a pressure cooker. It's cooking away on the inside, and the outer shell keeps it all together. And the water starts to evaporate because, you know, the bottom of a popcorn kettle is really hot. So then you've got all this really hot water vapor that's gas, you know, and it's squeezing outwards, and it's trapped in the little kernel. And at some point, as you make more and more of the water gas, the pressure inside goes up and up and up, and inevitably at some point, it's going to burst. And so that's the point where the popcorn pops. Where as soon as you start to rupture the outer shell, you make one little crack, and then all of the insides can rush out. And the really clever bit is that all of that cooking on the inside, that pressure cooker, that's been cooking all the starch. So then you've got all these bubbles in the starch, bubbles again, and they expand really rapidly, turning the whole thing inside out. Your starch is nice and cooked, so you've got this nice foam, basically, that suddenly pops, and there's your popcorn. So it's all because you've got gas under high pressure, and then you release it very suddenly, and you get this rapid expansion, and then you have popcorn.
Wow. That's more than I ever thought I would want to know about a popcorn, but it's fascinating. Hey, Helen, a listener on Twitter named Dean Owen Jones says, okay, so I've wondered this for years. Imagine it's raining heavily and you have no raincoat, no umbrella. Do you get more soaked if you run home or walk home? If you run, the water hits you harder. If you walk, you're in it longer.
Yes, this is a classic problem. And by the way, this is a really good example of what, you know, this, everyone can think about these things, right? The problems of physics, all of these questions you're answering, they've got proper physics in them, but they're not inaccessible in some lab somewhere. They're just like stuff that happens every day. And it's the same principle. That's what the book's really about. The same ideas that explain these basic things also explain, you know, big stuff. Anyway, so the raincoat thing. Now someone actually did an experiment on this. And so the general answer is that, like you said, there's this trade-off. Is it that if you're not running into the rain, that you can minimize the amount that hits you because you've only got, you know, you're not hitting as much of it? Or is it that the shorter the length of time you spend in the rain, the less water you get? Now, some professor, and I can't remember what university it was at, did a study where he made his students do this. And so these students had to walk and run in the rain. And I don't just remember, I'm pretty certain that the answer came out that it's about the same either way. And there's some things that depend on the exact situation. Because obviously if the rain is coming at an angle, you don't want to be running into rain. You don't want to increase your surface relative to the direction of the rain. So there's some little things that depend on the situation. But in general, I am pretty sure that the science on this says it's about the same both ways. It might depend on where you prefer getting wet, right? Whether you're more bothered about your head getting wet than your tummy. But in general, I think it's pretty much equal.
Helen, we're going to have to take a break right now. I'm speaking with physicist, oceanographer, broadcaster, and author Helen Cherusky for our latest Please Explain. Her book is Storm in a Teacup, The Physics of Everyday Life. Welcome to Midday, or welcome back to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart, speaking with Helen Cherisky, the author of Storm in a Teacup, The Physics of Everyday Life. Helen, we have a call from Robert in Huntington, New York, involving beer. Robert.
Hi, good afternoon. I noticed that when you pour a Guinness stout, the bubbles appear to go down instead of up. Is there an explanation for this?
Oh, that's a good one.
There is. Actually, I set this as a question in my first year fluid dynamics course here. There's a very clear answer to this. So the lovely thing about Guinness is that it kind of, you know, the bubbles in Guinness look very white, and it does look a bit like a waterfall down the outside of the glass. And as you say, the one thing that everyone knows about bubbles is that they go up. However, they don't all go up at the same speed. So the first thing is that if you take, you know, a bucket of water and you pour it into a swimming pool or something, you will see that the big bubbles rise faster than the smaller bubbles. And that's because the resistance, you know, the amount the water pushes back on them is matters less. So that's the first thing. Big bubbles rise faster. Now, at the bottom of a pint of Guinness, that's where the bubbles start, in the middle at the bottom. On the inside of that pint of Guinness, where you can't see, there are bubbles rising up, and they are nice big bubbles. So they're rising quite quickly. And they're not just rising through the drink, they're dragging it with it. So in the middle of your pint of Guinness, there's a kind of upside-down waterfall of bubbles pulling liquid upwards. So those bubbles get to the top, so that's all right. And the bubbles can stay at the top, but the liquid has to go back down the sides. So that's the first thing that's going on. You've got this up in the middle and down at the sides. Now, there are other bubbles in the liquid that are much smaller. And they're so small that instead of being carried upwards, they're so small that they're not really rising very quickly. They're rising so slowly you almost can't tell. And the hitting thing is that they're getting carried back down the outside. So they are rising upwards, but the liquid they're being carried by is moving downwards faster. So what you're seeing is bubbles that are trying to go up, but they're being carried down. It's like walking the wrong way up an escalator. You know, like you're going on down escalator and you're trying to walk up, but the down escalator is walking faster, is moving downwards faster. And that's what you're seeing. And the interesting thing about it is it depends on the size of the, and the shape of the glass. So a Guinness glass has a very distinctive shape. It's kind of narrow at the bottom and it gets wider at the top. And scientists that have studied this have shown that if you change the shape of the glass, the bubbles on the outside aren't always going downwards. But for a classic Guinness glass, proper Irish one, those tiny little bubbles can't win against the flood of water that's carrying them down, the flood of Guinness that's carrying them down. And so they look like they're going down, even though they're trying to rise up.
Robert, thank you very much for your call. So, Helen, you mentioned earlier talking about when you spill a liquid on a surface and you use a cloth or something, and that made me think, and I stopped you because I wanted to give you more time to talk about this. One common everyday thing is spilling a cup of coffee. Walk me through the science of what's happening when you spill coffee and when that dries up and creates a coffee stain.
Oh, yeah. So the world, this is interesting because what this highlights is the world is full of things that as adults, we've sort of stopped questioning. You know, kids like, why? And adults sort of notice things, but they've learned, and it's not a good thing to learn, to switch off the why question, right? So here's the thing. You spill a load of coffee. You know, you make a little puddle of coffee, and it's a filled-in shape, right? And if you leave it for long enough, which is scientifically justified, what you come back to is not a filled-in shape, right? It's a ring. So all the coffee has gone to the outside, like the water's evaporated, and then you've got a ring. So the question is, why is there no coffee in the middle of your ring?
Yeah.
Because there was coffee. So the answer has to do with the way it's actually surface tension again, and it's the way that they work. So the thing is that because there's slightly more surface at the edges, and because of the curve of the water, the coffee evaporates more quickly from the edges, right? So you're losing coffee from the edges, but then you've got a sort of bulge in the middle, and liquid doesn't like bulges, so it spreads out flatter. So it spreads the coffee a little bit towards the edges, and then more evaporates at the edges, and the coffee from the middle gets carried towards towards the edges. And so as the coffee evaporates, basically all the little coffee grains that are suspended in the liquid get carried out to the sides. Mm. And so you're left with a ring instead of a filled-in shape. And you can draw pictures with this. I have spent time trying to draw teddy bears with this and various a Christmas tree I once drew. Because you can, you know, you can make kind of, you know, coffee spills in different shapes, and then you let it evaporate. And if you've got the time and a phone that's got a time lapse camera, you know, take a photograph every minute, you can actually watch the coffee whoosh out to the outside. And so it's just all being carried along because of the evaporation and the way that surface tension works.
Wow. So Helen, I'm sorry, my mind is blown here. But I've got one more question about spilled coffee. So now, what happens when you wipe up that coffee with a paper towel versus a cotton towel?
Oh, paper versus cotton, that's interesting. So they're quite similar. They're both, have you seen a difference? So that, here's the thing. So I haven't seen a difference between mopping things up with paper and cotton, but maybe you've seen something I haven't. Have you seen a specific difference? Or are you asking a general question?
No, I'm just asking a general question. On a molecular level, is there any difference between the two?
Not really. They're both cellulose, so Okay. Both might be coated with something. So, they're both made of similar stuff. But what happens? The reason that they soak stuff up is that they're full of little holes. So they look, you know, kind of like a bath sponge, but smaller. They're full of these little holes and channels. And the interesting thing is that the cellulose that they're made of, which is a plant material, water really likes sticking to it. So the water that's on the, you know, that's in the puddle to be mopped up will kind of crawl up the insides along the walls of the foam, you know, the sponge, the towel.
Mm-hmm.
But then it doesn't just kind of coat the walls. Because of that surface tension we were talking about before, the middle, you know, you can imagine you've got a tube and you've coated the outsides. And if the outsides move higher and higher, you've then got a kind of hole with, you know, a gap in the middle. And surface tension doesn't like that. It wants to reduce the surface area to pull it flat. So surface tension pulls the surface flat, and so it pulls liquid up the middle. So all the attraction at the sides basically pulls liquid up the middle, and that's why towels soak up liquid. It's because the surface tension isn't letting that middle bit be left behind, and so everything kind of gets sucked up. And it's the same, you can see it really clearly. If you get a sugar lump and you hold it just in your coffee, because coffee's nice and dark, excuse me, and you see the coffee rise up inside the sugar lump, and it's because the water's kind of sticky, but the middle bits can't get left behind. And this is also what limits the height of a tree. This is the brilliant thing. None of these things are questions in isolation. So the same process, exactly the same process, is happening inside trees as they take water up from the roots to the top. And the thing that limits the height of a tree is the maximum height that this process works at.
Huh.
So that's why the redwoods in California can't get any taller. There's actually a and it's why they tend to be in moist places, because they're using everything they've got to get water from the ground up to their leaves, and they're getting a bit of help from the atmosphere. But basically, a tree cannot be any taller because you can't make pipes inside it small enough to let this process work of sucking up water inside the tree. So the same physics explains lots of different things. And that's why I got excited enough to write the book, is because once you've seen one of these things in one place, you then see it in lots of others, and it's the same physics. So instead of it, it's not a fact, it's a tool.
Yeah,
that
Helen,
you take with you.
I asked you about spilled coffee, and I love how we went from spilled coffee to trees and the height of trees in logical fashion. This is probably the most fascinating conversation I have had all week. Richard in Westchester has an interesting question, again, involving water. Richard.
Hello, everyone. I was told something that kind of floored me. A person told me hot water freezes faster than cold water. He quoted some principle, but I don't remember the name. That seems to go against all the laws of physics. Or was he saying it drops faster? And basically, I want to know, if I have two glasses outside below the 32 degrees of water, one hot and one cold, does the hot one become ice sooner than the cold?
So this is, interestingly, slightly contentious. So it is generally considered to be true in some cases. It's called the Mpemba effect. And the easiest way to see it, and it's a good time of year, like some this, it doesn't get cold enough to do this where I am in London, but where you, where some of your listeners are, it probably does. If it goes below, oh, I don't know, I don't know in Fahrenheit, but 15 Celsius. If you get a cup of hot coffee and you throw it in the air, if it's below minus 15 Celsius, whatever that is in Fahrenheit, it will freeze and form a kind of cloud. But if you do it with cold water, it won't freeze. And you can see the same thing. So originally, the student that originally observed this was doing it with ice cream. He noticed that if he was making ice cream and he heated the milk up and didn't let it cool to room temperature before he put it in the freezer, it would freeze more quickly. And his teacher was like, no, you're making that up. That's complete rubbish. And then it was later demonstrated to be true. So it's named after him. So it does seem to happen in some cases. And there's a few different ideas about why it happens. And some of them go deep into the... So water's quite weird from a molecular point of view. It's kind of simple, but it does some quite complicated things. And so some of the explanations go into all of that stuff. The one simpler explanation, and none of these have been conclusively proved, but the one simpler one is that when you've got a hot liquid, it's easier for, you know, you've got convection currents, basically. It can move around a little bit more because the warm water will rise to the top and the slightly cooler bits will sink. And so there's one idea that says that you bring the warmer water to the surface faster, and so it helps it lose heat more quickly. But there is some controversy about this because it doesn't work all the time. In some very specific conditions, you can cool stuff down and the cold water freezes before the hot water. But if you do it with a mug outside on a super cold day, you can absolutely see it for yourself. And, you know, you can try this. You can put out 2 cups of water and watch what happens. But yes, it is true that in some situations, hot water will freeze faster than cold.
Richard, thank you for your question, and mystery for Richard solved. Hey, Helen, can we talk about ketchup?
Yeah.
and why it's so hard to get ketchup out of those glass bottles? I know how to do it, but why the problem?
So this is one of those things I quite like. And then I realized, I wrote this chapter and everyone got excited about it. And then I realized that so ketchup bottle manufacturers have taken the fun away because now there's plastic bottles. And it's like, no, you have to stay with the glass bottles and teach people how to solve the problem. That's the thing to do. Anyway, so the thing with the glass bottle, like we all remember this, you know, when we got glass bottles everywhere, is that you can see it in, you know, diners and pubs and whatever, is that there's always someone with a glass bottle and they hold it upside down and nothing comes out. And then they kind of shake the bottle and nothing comes out. And then they shake a bit harder, And eventually half the bottle comes out all at once. And there's like ketchup all over the fries and everyone's cross. So the deal with it is that ketchup does something really interesting, which is that the how runny it is depends on how fast you're trying to move it. And so basically, if you're not moving it, ketchup is pretty solid, doesn't really go anywhere. So you hold a bottle upside down and it's never going to empty out because it's not, you know, you're not forcing it to move, so it's kind of solid. But once you start it moving, if you shake it really, really hard, once it starts to move, it can move quickly and it becomes runny. So once you've got it moving, it becomes runny. And that's why once you shake it hard enough, the half the bottle comes out at once. So the trick, the solution to this, should you ever see a glass bottle, and I think people who have cafes and restaurants, you know, we want the glass bottles back because we want to play the game, is if you hold it, the bottle at an angle and you tap it on the neck, then you just get a little bit of ketchup at once, because what you're doing is you're just forcing the ketchup in the neck to move. So only that bit is runny, but the rest of it stays nice and solid. So you can get a small amount of runny ketchup out and leave the rest of it in the bottle. So that's the solution to the problem. And again, you know, it's got uses in other places. So this is how snails move, which is a long... I mean, you thought the tree was bonkers, right? The snails are even more bonkers. snail mucus is like this. It has this property that the faster you move it, the runnier it is. And so, a snail kind of glides along and it never leaves the ground.
Right.
The thing is that different bits of the underside of the snail are moving at different speeds. So the bits that are moving slowly, act like the brake, they're gluing the snail down. And the bits that are moving quickly, they're just shooting over the top because those bits of mucus are runny. And so a snail can effectively walk without taking its feet off the ground, you know, its foot off the ground. And it's just because of the same thing as the ketchup.
Helen, you totally anticipated the question I was going to ask you. I was going to move move from ketchup to snails, and again, you moved easily from one to the other. You know what? I want to take this question from Charles in Somers, New York. Charles.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air.
I'm here. This is not exactly a household question. It's at the other end of the scale, more or less. But, you know, they finally recorded gravitational waves last year. And are you there?
Yeah, we're here. We're here.
Gravitational waves were recorded at a cataclysmic event, which took place billions of years ago, the colliding of two black holes. And I know that gravity is by far the weakest force of the forces, the four forces.
Uh-huh.
So you need a really tremendous event like that to make detectable gravity or gravitational waves. But in theory, is it true that any event that involves gravity will produce waves, but they're just too small for us to see, for instance, or for us to detect? For instance, gravitational waves, would they come from an earthquake and just be too tiny for us to detect?
That's a great question, Charles. Helen, what's your answer for Charles?
So the deal with the gravitational waves is kind of, so you know, so we're, imagine like the Earth is going around the Sun because the Sun has, you know, it has mass and so it's pulling us towards it. So if the thing about gravitational waves is if you instantly took away the Sun, like just in an instant, the gravity would go immediately, right? But the problem is the fastest anything can travel is the speed of light. So we wouldn't know that the gravity had gone away until the length of time it takes light to reach Earth, because that's the time it takes us to find out. So that's the deal with gravitational waves. It's that something that has mass moves or changes so quickly that its gravitational pull also changes, but it takes a while to get to you because it takes a while to find out.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, like you say, these events are super big, that's a lot of gravity messing around. So these black holes colliding, they didn't just thump into each other. What happened was that they spiraled around. So what you're actually seeing is the mass that is, you know, that the gravitational attraction is to, it's moving around and around and around in circles, so it's getting nearer and further and nearer and further. And that's part of what you're seeing when you see a gravitational wave. It's the moving about of gravity, of whatever it is you're attracted to. So in principle, you're right that every time something moves, you know, you're changing the gravity, the gravitational attraction to it. But in practice, the change is so tiny that it's extremely hard to detect and possibly theoretically undetectable because, you know, there's a site, you know, things, atoms and things get so small.
Right.
And you go, there's a limit to how far down the size scale you can actually measure at
Helen,
all. And
Helen, let me ask you one last question in the 14 seconds that we have left.
I'll try and be quick.
And it's on gravity. Are there places on Earth where the force of gravity can feel different than where I am right now in New York City or where you are in London?
Yes. Isn't this fantastic? So the general gravity of Earth, you know, we're sitting on something that's mostly spherical. It's quite big. There's a bigger pull. However, there are places with big, heavy, dense mountains. There's lots of ice on Antarctica. There's all these big, heavy things that are sort of distributed around the planet. And so mountains, for example, do have a noticeable gravitational pull towards them. So if you hold a pendulum, it will just be pulled towards sideways towards the mountain just a little bit, which caused a lot of problems for the first people to try and make maps using plumb lines because their angles were all wrong, because the mountains were pulling the gravity slightly to the side. So absolutely, yes, it does vary, but only by a tiny bit.
This has been an incredible conversation. You have been listening to Helen Cherisky. She is the author of Storm in a Teacup, The Physics of Everyday Life. Helen, thank you very much for being here.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.